This is a No Surf Music Burning River Fireside Chat with guest Bill Kirchen. I'm your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammond. For the best in Americana, alt country, indie rock, and more, point your browser to nosurfmusic.com. This is your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammond, and this is another edition of No Surf Music's Burning River Fireside Chats. And joining me today is not just a guitar legend, but a certified member of guitar royalty.
Whoa.
Indeed. The Titan of the Telecaster, the King of Diesel Billy, Mr. Bill Kirchen. How are you doing today,
sir? Man, I'm real good. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm really glad to have you here because... You actually are one of my favorite guitar players.
You've
had a big
influence
on a lot of people that I love as well.
Well, thank you very much. I sure appreciate that.
Absolutely. So for people who may not know Bill by name, you definitely know a lot of his work because he was most famous probably as a member of Commander Cody and his Lost Planet Airmen. And he is, in fact, the gentleman who wrote a number of their best songs, including, of course, Hot Rod Lincoln.
I didn't write that.
You didn't write that?
No, that was an oldie when we got to it, but I played the guitar hook on it. I wrote Too Much Fun and Semi-Truck and
Right.
One of those nights, a few of those. And I sang Seeds and Stems, but I did not write Lincoln or Seeds and Stems.
Okay. Well, I knew you didn't write Seeds and Stems. That was Mr. Frain and one
Farrell,
of the other men.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, you see, I'm learning something
You'll
with everybody
every
right
day.
Here.
I don't want to take credit for that. It's a great song.
It is a great song.
Yeah, but I did not write it.
Okay. Well, you have written plenty of great ones, and like I said, you're a terrific player. But interestingly enough, before you ever got to the guitar, you started out as a trombonist, is that correct?
Right, yeah, I was a classical, you know, trombone player, played in band through high school from fourth grade on, and it wasn't until about, 1964, I guess when I was a junior, that I bailed and pretty much stuck to the fretted instrument, started on the banjo, old-timey five-string banjo, Pete Seeger, how to play the banjo.
Mm-hmm.
And then I learned guitar after that, and I started playing acoustic guitar and finger-picking acoustic guitar before I ever played electric.
Okay.
So that's how the chronology there.
And you sort of started off in the more folky end of music,
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Well, it was during the big folk scare, you know, and I went, I saw Bob Dylan in my high school solo acoustic in 63 or 64. I went to the Newport Folk Festival in 64 and 65 and saw... I mean, everybody, all the old blues guys, Sunhouse, Skip James, Mans Lipkin, Sleepy John Estes with Hammy Nixon and Yank Rochelle.
John Hurt was there, right?
And Mississippi John Hurt. That was my, hero. That's who I wanted to be when I grew up. And I saw him, and I saw Dylan, I saw the Staple Singers, I saw Bill Monroe, I saw Johnny Cash. I saw just an unbelievable... And then all the young Cambridge scene, the Quescott Jug Band with Maria D'Amato and Jeff Muller. And then I came back in 65 and I saw a bunch more great stuff, including Dylan going electric with members of the Butterfield Band. I saw the Butterfield Band there with Bloomfield. So that was my sort of coming age musical. That's what got me riled up and ruined me for normal work.
Okay. Well, one of the reasons why I like to talk to folks like you who... you know, have been in the music business so long is because you really are a link back to those older people who influenced you.
Right.
And those Newport days, you know, I have a lot of those albums on vinyl, and I can imagine how cool that was.
Well, you can see me in, if you have Blues at Newport 64, rather, you can see the shot of Mississippi John Hurt's head with his little bowler hat, and if you look into the upper left-hand corner, there's me, bigger in life, 16 years old, with a big, between my junior and senior year, with a big grin on my face going,
Well,
so I'm right there on the cover, and that was extraordinary. I didn't mean to interrupt you,
but
when you mentioned the albums, those were extraordinarily, tremendously great times. I was just looking at a website that somebody had. He was a little bit older than me in Philadelphia, and he has all the photos from that era. And he was commenting, too, on what a precious time of his life that was, and I would say the same for me.
Okay. Well, since those, I know you said Mississippi John was sort of your guitar hero.
Yeah, right.
Was he the best one that you saw in that era?
Best. They were all. Okay. It was all so great. I never been able to think about it in that way. I mean, I saw Son House, who was just frightening, literally made the hair on my neck go up. He talked real soft and went, hey man, hey man. Then all of a sudden, his bottleneck cranked up the neck on that Steel National, and his eyeballs literally, as far as I could tell, roll out of his head, and he started singing Death Letter Blues, and the hair on my neck, little 16-year-old white neck, stood up. But I saw, you know, I loved it all, man. I saw, you know, the Staples singers, Pop Staples. I saw Georgia Sea Island singers. I saw some Moving Star Hall singers where the guy, as far as I remember, just had a crutch he was bouncing on the stage, and great vocal harmonies. So my favorite guitarists were, though, at that time, would be Doc Watson and John Hurt.
Okay.
That's the stuff I love most.
Okay. So how did you transition from that, you know, simpler, more acoustic, folky stuff into the more complicated country rock stuff that you ended up doing with Grand Cody?
It's what I discovered next. It was my next big thrill, kind of. And I already, you know, like the Beatles and Stones and stuff, and I already was familiar with Electric Chicago Blues, so I'd heard that. Then all of a sudden, I hooked up with the guys, and I was playing kind of folk rock by then. I had an electric guitar, and I was playing, you know, we had a band called The Seventh Seal, and we did long jams on whatever we could get together to play, some Motown stuff, some Donovan songs, some blues, Diving Duck Blues. But then I hooked up with the Cody Bunch in about 67, and I had a crash course and stuff I really did not know, which was starting with Hank Williams and then some Lefty Frizzell and from that era, and Jimmy Rogers. But Hank, a lot of Hank. We played a lot of Hank. Our lead singer at that time was from Alabama and knew that stuff inside and out. So I got all those, discovered the Bakersfield. I really enjoyed the West Coast country sound of the Bakersfield crowd of Merle Haggard, Buck Owens, Wynn Stewart, Red Simpson, that stuff. All I made at Capitol Studios, that big round tower Capitol building. Mm-hmm. And James Burton on some of the guitar parts, Don Rich, Roy Nichols. I loved that. I loved Red Foley with Hank Garland playing guitar with Red Foley. And so I got all that at once. At the same time, I discovered rockabilly with Gene Vincent and that great stuff. And, you know, Elvis and Scotty Moore, and later Elvis and Hank Garland or Grady Martin, whoever played there, and Elvis with James Burton. So I got that all at once in about a short 2-year span. I got a very deep education in honky-tonk electric guitar. Specifically, a lot of those guys played Tele, and that's when I decided to get a Telecaster, when I realized that James Burton, Buck Owens, and Don Rich, and Roy Nichols all played Telecasters.
Okay, and that actually brings me up to something I did want to ask you about, because I know there's a really interesting story about how you came to acquire your Telecaster.
Boy, I hate to say this, because there's an internet story and there's the real story.
Okay, well, that's why we're here. Okay. So let's hear the real one.
Well, the internet story's better.
Okay.
First, I'm going to tell you what the legend is, that I was sitting on a bus stop, and the guy next bench, and the guy traded me his guitar. Well, we were sitting on a bench, all right, but we were both working, delivering blueprints by a motorcycle in San Francisco. Was, by coincidence, who knows, the last job I had, it would have been 1967 or so. And we were both delivering blueprints, and we got to talking, and he had a Tele, and I had a Gibson SG. Mm-hmm. And Pete Townsend had just come through. No, this would have been 68. Pete Townsend had just come through San Francisco smashing up a Gibson SG. He wanted one. I wanted a Tele. Just swapped. And that Tele served me well. I played it for 40 years straight. Only recently kind of retired it in the last few years.
Okay. And why did you decide to do that?
Well, I found another one with a bigger, fatter neck that I really liked. And by this time, that Tele had kind of been changed. The pickups had been changed and everything. So I wanted to go back to a more traditional Tele sound. And that I didn't pick that Tele. It picked me. So I later just really got to thinking, once I found a Tele with a fat neck, I realized I liked it a lot more. And I go back and play the old coal burner, as we call it, because the legend is that it's old, that we had to convert it from being a coal burning guitar to electric. Once I go back to that, it feels like playing a mandolin. But I still love it. But I'm playing a Tele now, an all pine one made by Rick Kelly and Carmen Street Guitars in Greenwich Village. And it's made out of recycled 150-year-old pine salvaged from Jim Jarmusch's loft in the Bowery.
Wow.
So there you have it.
That's pretty impressive right there. So because you are so famous for playing a Telecaster, I just want to ask you, what is it about that sound that is so important to you?
Well, I don't really quite understand it myself, but it's, for one thing, to me, it's the big, sort of the clearest, purest, cleanest guitar tone. Why, I don't know. And the other thing about a Tele, it's about the simplest electric guitar out there. I mean, it's a plank and a stick. It's got, the Telecaster's got two pickups, one three-way switch, and two knobs. End of story, you know, and that's what it is. And it's very, it isn't a big sustaining rock tone. You kind of have to play it in. I really can't explain why I like it so much, but I just love the purity of the tone is the best way I can describe it. There's a lot of different Tele tones, but as a rule, that's what I like.
Okay. Sounds great.
I've just lately gone to playing with no pedals whatsoever. I just go straight into an amp. Yeah, and it happened kind of by accident. I never used much. I used a delay maybe and maybe a clean boost, maybe a dirty boost. That would be it. That's the only three pedals that affected the tone, and sometimes just two. But lately, you know, I ended up without a pedal board a couple days in a row, and I went, wait a minute, I like this. And now I'm just not using them. I just go straight in, one chord, one guitar, one chord, and one amp. I use a 68 Fender Deluxe Reaper.
Okay, okay. And now I know you mentioned that when you did the guitar trade, you were out in San Francisco.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you founded the Commander Cody Band in the Lost Planet Airmen in, 1967? Is that correct?
Well, we started in Ann Arbor in about 67, and okay. I moved to California, I guess, 68. I guess that's when I was out there, so it would have been 68 when I got that Tele.
And you grew up in Ann Arbor?
I grew up in Ann Arbor, yeah, and that's where the band started. And then it broke up, and I moved to California.
I got it.
And I convinced the rest of the band to come on out and join us.
Okay. And
I thought that we had a chance to really, you know, make a career out of it. The guy who we'd made be the commander, he had gone off to teach art in Oshkosh, and the other guy had gone off to get a degree in Georgia Tech, you know. And so I went out to play music in California, and I had a little band I was working with out there. And so that was it.
Okay. So what was it about that San Francisco scene at the time that you thought you could be successful in?
I just thought that there was a whole room for us out there. People were open-minded to all different kinds of music, and we were playing a kind of music, specifically swing of the 40s, western swing of the 40s and 50s, rockabilly, mm-hmm. hard blood and guts country, not soft country rock or kind of L.A. smooth out, just basically blood and guts country, and truck driving songs. And I felt that there was such a broad, you know, there was a niche for us. Nobody was doing that, and yet it struck me there were so many other kinds of music they'd embrace. Why not that? Plus, mm-hmm. that's where I wanted to be, man. I wanted to be in California. You know, it was Go West Young, man. That was the idea. I couldn't wait to get out there.
I gotcha. And, I mean,
plus, I told the band, I said, listen, man, if you come out here and play outdoors, girls take their shirts off.
Oh, well.
So the band was like, bingo, they were there. This was the 60s. That was a big deal.
That's
still is a big deal.
Hey, yeah, right? Maybe we'll see some tonight.
The powerful force. Right.
Anything probably is possible.
Not. I'm going to leave my shirt on.
Okay, well, so am I, that's for sure. I left one of my shirts upstairs just so it's sitting on a chair for me.
Okay,
but
good.
So I think you actually hit on one of the parts that I've always thought was most interesting about Commander Cody and the band's music, which is you had such a broad range.
Right.
I mean, you did everything from, you know, Minnie the Moocher to,
right.
you know, stuff that you'd just written 5 minutes beforehand.
Right, yeah.
How did that come about? Was it that you all had different influences and you brought that together? Or what was the formula for that?
Well, I guess that's a good point. That would be, there were four lead singers in the band.
Mm-hmm.
Well, three lead singers and a lead talker, the Commander. Of course, he had the big hit, you know, and great. And, but we all were allowed to do whatever we wanted. And we would suggest songs for the other people, or maybe like Billy C. and George wrote Seeds and Stems, but I got to sing it. You know,
mm-hmm.
it was perceived to be, I had the pretty ballad voice, maybe. And John Tichy and the old Commander had been buddies in frat bands together and had been playing before I ever met them, and were a little older than me. So everybody, there was four singers and eight of us total, so there was a lot of influence. We'd ride around, we had a bus. We traveled out with 12 bunks in an upper lounge with in a lower lounge, card playing and whatnot up down there, up and listening to cassettes. Back in the day, that was what we had. And so whatever kind of music was brought through, we were able to assimilate.
Okay.
And we went retro pretty hard. I mean, we did not listen to. I missed rock. like all the English rock bands. I totally didn't hear them because I wasn't paying attention. I went retro at about 68 and couldn't tell you what happened until I kind of surfaced hanging out with the Nick Lowe crowd, you know, in the late 70s. So.
Well, that is actually an interesting point because, of course, your musical career, you know, may have been most famous for that era, but you've been doing a lot of great stuff for a long time since then. And when
I've been lucky to keep working.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, I mean, how long has it been now that you've been a professional musician?
Man. Well, certainly 40 years, but more like 40. I mean, that job was the last job I had, and that was in...
You said like 68?
69. No, 69? It was 69, okay. I think. Yeah, so I think, you know, I think I got a good 44 years going. Is that 44
yeah.
years ago?
Yeah, sounds right.
Holy crinkle.
Well, that's a pretty good run, right?
Time's fun when you're having flies, isn't
it? Exactly. And then in addition to your work with Commander Cody, then you went off and founded the Moonlighters. That was your next project. And then a number of years later, Too Much Fun. Yep. Which is the group that you're playing with now.
Yep.
And that is sort of a much more concise group, I guess I would say.
We're a little hillbilly SWAT team, man. We got three guys, guitar, bass, and drums, and we just go get it.
Okay. Well, that, I think, is a big difference from what you were doing.
Sure.
Which one do you prefer?
I like it all, and I loved everything I did, but honestly, I don't ever yearn to be back in an eight-piece band again. It was great, but it was, you know, it's delightful being in a trio. We can do anything we want. We can turn on a dime, you know, make sense economically. I don't think it's just sweet grapes or whatever the opposite of sour grapes is, but I really like my life today. Is much more than any time in my life, really. And I think as you get older, I'm going to be 65 in a couple of days, you know, you don't take shit for granted. I'm delighted that I'm sitting here with a guitar in my hand. When you're young, you think, whatever, you know, it's, you know, we sometimes, you know, wished back then that we were like the Eagles in the success rate and stuff, and we didn't really, maybe weren't able to enjoy fully the success we did have, which was great. We traveled the world, man. We had more fun than we deserved, you know. So I think it's precious to me now, and the music I like every bit as much, if not more. I think I can focus better on it. I'm not getting loaded anymore. I haven't done that in like, you know, almost 30 years, and that's been nice. that was kind of a foggy time, you know. So
I hear that from a lot of people who are playing.
Oh yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, I hit the wall. So it was many other people, and I was lucky enough to get out the other end. So I feel very grateful for that. Nothing but gratitude for that.
I got you, and I mean that was. Not only, I think, part of the era that you played in, but very specifically to the San Francisco scene, too. There was a lot more going on there.
Right.
Not necessarily as much alcohol, but other stuff.
Right, yeah. Well, alcohol was right there, too, but right, a lot of drugs, and yeah. Absolutely.
So, being that you've got this long career to look back on, what do you think have been the biggest changes in the music industry as a whole, not just in your own career as you've grown older, but from when you started out to now?
Well, I'd say one of the things as it relates to me, I don't really see how you could start out today as we did, with eight stoned hippies in a band playing music of a decade prior, you know. And we were good. I'm not knocking us. We played great, you know, I think. I mean, it was a good
song. So I think so, too. I love the band. I mean,
yeah. But I don't think you could do that and expect to carve out a career in the music business today. I think it's become more top-heavy. More of the money's at the top.
Right.
We used to be on three-band bills, sometimes at the bottom, sometimes in the middle, sometimes at the top. But all three bands got paid. And I don't know that that's happening. Nor do I necessarily think that there is a direct pipeline from the clubs to the small rooms to the concert halls to the stadiums. I'm not sure it works like that anymore. Right. I don't know how it works. And I don't think anybody does. So that's different. Now, the other parts of it, I don't know, because I'm not obviously competing on a...
Hey, brother.
I'm not competing on a, you know, major league level. I have a niche market, and we make a living doing it, and it's cool, you know. So in that sense... It's hard for me to say how different it is, because I'm not right in that party right now. I've got my own party that's working fine, you know. And, of course, the Internet's changed things in many ways, and luckily, a lot of my people still buy CDs, which we sell at the shows.
Right.
And it's invaluable to me for publicizing my what I do to a niche market that's spread thin around. So it's great. The internet's been fantastic for me, as has internet radio and satellite mm-hmm. radio and all that. No complaints there.
No complaints. Well, that's good to hear, because there have been a few of them out from a number of artists tell me about some of them. But.
Yeah, sure. I have my complaints about that.
Okay.
About what it's been, that aspect of how it's helped me.
I got
right,
you.
The fact that Pandora's not paying people for, that's bullshit.
That's what I was thinking specifically.
Yeah. No, yeah. Absolutely. That's bullshit. I don't do that. I don't download like that. I buy a tune on iTunes for a buck. Come
right.
on. You know, get a buck somewhere and buy the damn tune. That's what I
yeah.
say.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just as somebody, you know, who operates more in that world than, you know, in what you used to do, because I'm much younger, obviously.
Right.
But, I mean, there's advantages and disadvantages. And like you said, like, the internet gives you an opportunity to connect with fans
right.
in a way you never could have.
Right.
And Pandora and those services, new people can be discovered. Problem
that's
is,
true.
Once you're discovered, where do you get paid?
Right.
You
exactly.
know?
No, and I was on the board of governors of the Narrows chapter in D.C., and by coincidentally, when we got a Grammy nomination, we didn't
mm-hmm.
win, we were Grammy losers, but we went to the big show in L.A., you know. And I was of mixed mind about that, because the file sharing and stuff was, while it was certainly ethically wrong, ended up helping me, who was starting a second career as a solo artist.
Okay.
So, you know, it helped spread. So it was hard for me. I made me slightly more sympathetic to both sides of the story.
I gotcha. Well, you do sell a lot of CDs, as you
yeah,
mentioned, still. And you just came out with a brand new one, so I want to talk about that some.
Seeds and Stems.
Absolutely.
Yeah, man.
And what's interesting, I thought about that, is that it's in a lot of ways a retrospective of pretty much your whole career in one way or another. It's got, in addition to, of course, Seeds and Stems, the title song, a whole bunch of really great ones, but just a few Mama Hated Diesels.
Oh, yeah.
Which I love because my name is in it.
There you go, exactly.
Although I don't know why she hates me.
Why?
I'm such
I don't
a
know.
Nice
What'd
guy,
you do
right?
To your mom,
seriously.
Man, dude.
Too Much Fun, which, of course, is the lead-off track and the band name as well.
Huh?
You're known actually for doing a lot of Dylan covers,
right?
And you've got "It Takes a Lot to Laugh, It Takes a Train to Cry"
right.
on this album, which I've always loved as a title.
It's a great,
title. Isn't it?
You start thinking about what Dylan? What the hell? Dylan, that's crazy talk, Bob. Stuff.
Well, he used a lot to be crazy because he did
exactly.
so well,
that's what
right?
We pay him for, yeah. That's
exactly.
It's his job description.
And, of course, on top of that, you've got a whole bunch of others, but the key, I think, of course, is Hot Rod Lincoln.
Right.
But what made you want to do an album like that at this point in your career?
Well, I'll tell you what. The other two albums we made for Proper Records, the first one was a lot of new original material, and it was with the band that I toured the world as, with Nick Lowe fronting it, with
mm-hmm.
the Nick Lowe and the Impossible Birds. And we wanted to go to England to make that record. And I wrote a bunch of new material for it, and I got my favorite songwriters to contribute. We did a couple of covers. And that was that. The next record, also a whole bunch of new material, and we did duets of all the people that I had played with through the years that were still alive. And they had to be people I'd actually worked with, either played guitar with in the studio or on stage, not just people that I'd met or
gotcha.
Opened for, you know. So that was that. And the third thing that we needed to fill that out was all the songs that had retained their, you know, action in our live show that we still are doing and people still request all the time that we didn't necessarily have on CD, or they're spread on a bunch of other ones. Also, we wanted the opportunity. I'm a slow learner, man. I'm better now than I was 5 years ago, I think. I think I can sing
okay.
way better. Just, I don't know why I'm such a slow learner. There's a lot of great musicians who peaked when they were like 18 or 29 or something. And not me, man. I'm just gradually putting it together. So we wanted this band that had been on the road and really tight, we wanted to be able to present that, how we do this stuff now. Sometimes completely reimagined, like Swing Fever and Womb to the Tomb, and
mm-hmm.
sometimes just, you know, tightened up or whatever. So that's why we did it.
Okay. Well, you brought up a point that I found really interesting when I was listening to it, which is how different, not all of the songs, but some of them are
right.
from their originals.
We did.
You know, and especially like you said, back in the 60s and 70s, you were playing with, like, what, an eight-piece band, something like that. Yeah. And now you're a trio. So did you feel that any of the versions that you did today are better because it's a smaller group, or worse, or anything like that? Or?
I like some of them better. Some of them, I think, have a little more energy. I think this version of Too Much Fun is the best one. Mm-hmm. I think it's got the most energy of anyone. I had no problem. I love the Cody one, too. I didn't sing it. Billy C did, so I don't, you know, I mean, it was great. But, you know, once again, it's really hard. It's apples and oranges. But I certainly stand behind these versions we did. I think we did them intentionally this way. Mm-hmm. It's not like we couldn't have done something else. And I brought in our fourth guy, Austin DeLone, a lot of a great keyboard player from West Coast. So we didn't try to just, you know. So, you know, I don't remember what the question was, but my answer is yes, no, maybe, I don't know.
Okay, that sounds fair. But you did record it live.
Well, in pretty studio, live. Correct? I mean, okay. We did. It wasn't strictly live, but it was more that way. We got more, like, complete takes, more all of us playing at once than usual. Still, there was a lot of overdubs, but there was a lot of just even vocals that happened at the same time. And certainly a lot of the times when the whole rhythm and lead guitar parts would happen at the same time. But we overdubbed a bunch, too. You can't help yourself.
Well, yeah, I mean, some of it's going to happen,
the technology's
right?
there.
Right.
Matter of fact, I'm going to overdub this whole I see there's room for the click track.
There is. We can change a little bit on it.
Put some maracas, bongos.
But did you like that process more, since you are a live band together? You know,
yeah, being able to play it? I would love to do it more. I think if I had more nerve, I would, you know, be great to do it, just a real live album. But it's funny because what you can get away with live is harder to then you hear it played back, and the stuff that is perfectly fine live sometimes just doesn't cut it on a record. Mm. You know, we're so used to hearing. And I don't know that it's a good thing, where we're so used to hearing things that are time-shifted into perfect.
Right.
And I don't like that. We didn't use a click track or anything. I like the song to breathe tempo-wise. But you're used to also perfect intonation, and so I don't know. I mean, not to say that ours is. We tried to leave it funky, leave some rough edges. But it is nice to be able to just play all at once.
Okay. Well, that actually brings up something about Hot Rod Lincoln.
Yes, sir.
Which, like we said, is probably the song you're best known for. Yeah. And the version on this record has a whole sort of interlude in the middle, where you really get a chance to sort of show off your guitar chops.
Exactly. It's my show off.
Okay. Well,
but it's also my trip down, this is the history of the electric guitar.
Right. Too, you know? I mean, you go pretty much from Johnny Cash on up to the Sex Pistols and everything in between and on both sides. And I understand that started as sort of a live thing just decided to do.
We never rehearsed it originally. We eventually tried to tighten it up for some recording. But it started out, we were doing different car horns, and all of a sudden without warning the band, I snuck in the Folsom Prison lick. You know, and then it was off to the races. And then it was just, we'd throw in a lick, you know, and then try to keep the band, try to just catch it as it went by, try to play it as well as we could, but not plan in advance what was going to happen. And it kind of settled into an order of, you know, but it was all just for our own amusement. But it turned into a tremendous crowd pleaser. And as one drummer who I briefly had said to me, he goes, after about two, it's hard for a drummer. He's a new drummer, you know, he's a great guy, but he said, we can do this song every night. And I went, yeah, we are, pretty much, you know, which is fine with me. And people say, are you sick of it? And no, I'm not sick of it. It's a great song, and it's challenging to play, and it's a tremendous crowd pleaser. So I love it. I love doing it.
Very cool.
Yeah. I like my job.
It's a great job, right?
It is a great job.
And what I found most interesting about that myself was, you know, here you are, an incredibly well-respected guitar man, and you're sort of, you know, giving the proper due to all the people who came
before. I'm exposing myself as a thief, essentially, of all these licks. You know, you can see where you're like, oh, that's where that's at. But that's good, because, you know, we all learn. You all take what you can get and then move. Then, you know, I started out imitating, you know, on electric guitar, trying to learn some Buck Owens, Don Rich solos, and some Merle Haggard stuff, and play some Scotty Moore rockabilly stuff. And then eventually you make it your own. That's how it works. And so I was glad to be able to say, well, here's my reference list, you know, of the guitar players that influenced me. And that was just the electric ones from that era. I didn't even go back to, like, you know, Charlie Christians or or sideways to Doc Watson. Well, I guess I did do Doc Watson in there. I can't remember. I did do Doc Watson. Well, if I didn't, I won't remember now.
Okay, there you go. Yes, it is brand new, so I've only had a chance to listen to it a few times myself. But yeah, I know you had the whole All the Kings. And
all the Kings, all the Rays.
Yes.
Yeah, we got all that.
So I don't know if you got to the Watson, but...
No, I would have been early on. I think it's there. Anyway,
Whatever. Well, it's either there or it's not, but there's still a lot of great people that you mentioned and play a little lick from them. So what would you say is your personal favorite from that collection? Is it Too Much Fun? Because you said you really... The new album. I mean...
Oh, geez. Again, I'm not good with these favorites because I have... I'm not complaining.
I mean, they're kind of your babies, too.
Yeah,
right?
It's like... The reason being, they all, to me, fulfill a different purpose, kind of. And I enjoy music so much that I embrace a whole lot of different stuff. But, I mean, I do have sort of... Some of my favorite... you can kind of tell because you tend to front-load an album. So stuff like Too Much Fun and Seeds and Stems and Semi-Truck. That was the stuff that, we thought really clicked. But I like it all. I love Talking About Chicken, the last song. I love The Lincoln Cut. And, it's hard to say. But that would be so much. I guess I was going to pick favorite. Mama Hated Diesels. Come on.
It's a great one. It really is.
Tell Me the Reason. Flip Flop. That's got that neat hole popping thing. So I like a lot of it. I'm excited about the record.
Cool. Well, I definitely enjoyed it, and I want to recommend it to all of our listeners.
Well, thank you.
And like I said, we'll have a review, so everybody, by the time this comes out, will be able to read my exact thoughts on
it. Fantastic.
But I just have one last thing to wrap up.
Yes, sir.
As you mentioned, you're just about to turn 65.
You got it. Medicare.
Social Security and all that, right? But first of all, happy early birthday.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations. It's a milestone.
And happy early birthday to you, since I'm sure you have some.
It's actually a month from today, so
there you go. Happy birthday.
Thank you. But I guess my question is, that is an age, obviously, where most people are looking at retiring if they haven't already. You're still playing 200 dates a year.
Yeah. I like my job. Uh-huh. I don't want to give it up. I don't have to, and I'm not going to take Social Security. I'm going to stay out there working, and not that that's mutually exclusive. But no, I like my job. I like it a lot. It's great. And I'm still healthy, so what the heck.
Okay. So for the foreseeable future, you're just going to keep going, right?
Yeah, sure. Nice. Got to write some more songs next. I need to write some new tunes. And we're on the big endless tour this summer. No, it's great. I got the best job in the world. Many days.
Absolutely. Well, it's great to hear that you're going to keep at it. And like I said, this new album is great. So we want to hear a lot more from you in the future. So
thank you very much.
Let's keep it up, right?
Diesel, thanks a million.
Thank you very much, Bill. It was terrific meeting you.
Nice to meet you too. And, nice questions. I enjoyed your obvious interest in your going to the trouble to do the homework. Well, I appreciate that.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun talking to you too. And I want to thank you again for joining us.
All right, man.
And this has been another edition of No Surf Music Burning River Fireside Chats.
Wow.
And we're going to go up and listen to Bill do some rocking here. Thanks a lot, everybody. This has been a No Surf Music Burning River Fireside Chat. This is your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammett, signing off. Remember, No Surf Music is your source for the best in Americana, alt-country, indie rock, and more. For original reviews and interviews, visit nosurfmusic.com.